Track, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. The tie underneath should tell you so. David Steele is here, Baltimore Positive, and we're Pappas. It's been a little while. It's been like a, maybe a year and a half since we were here. Mike Borders is going to be here a little later on. We'll be talking a lot of baseball before this is over with. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I've already started to give away lottery tickets around here, and we've had some winners here from Blue Cross Blue Shield who are having a wonderful group lunch here today. I'll be giving these away in the future through the holidays, wherever the Maryland Crab Cake Tour takes us. We're up in Cockeysville today. All that brought to you by our friends at Goodwill. My wife and I are rolling the sleeves up on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. Goodwill feeds 3,000 people lunch, Thanksgiving lunch between 11 and 2 down at the convention center. If you want to volunteer, throw me a note, nessatbaltimorepositive.com. Still can use some volunteers on Wednesday the 23rd. And our friends at Window Nation, I'm not going to put the hat on because my hair looks great. 866-90-NATION, keeping me nice and toasty. I've been trying to get this cat on. I text him. I'm writing a book, man. It's a plague. I'm writing a book. Well, let me know when the book comes out. Then the book comes out, and I get skipped on the book tour. It was always a choice, picking up the baton of athlete activism. You know, I said all week, I said, David Steele's written a book on race and sports and America. Is that right? Does that sound?
That's what it is. Yeah.
All right. Then I got it right. Thank you.
Absolutely. Race and sports and America throughout the history of race and sports and America. So we go back, but we also bring it all the way to where we are today.
I'm going to be honest with you, and I'm going to make an admission, a little bit of a Dave Chappelle moment for me. I'm going to walk the tightrope, okay? I was a sports writer at the paper back in the 80s, and there was a huge initiative to try to make the newsroom look a little more colorful than it did at that time. We're talking about 35 years ago, right? And anytime they would wind up hiring a black columnist anywhere in America, the black columnists, I don't want to say main beat, but when you're a columnist, you're giving your point of view. There was a very, very only from black eyes kind of view of it. And I didn't always understand it, right? Even as a guy that wanted to write, wanted to be Ken Rosenthal, wanted to be John Eisenberg, wanted to be the Mitch Albom, you know, name any of the... You were one of those guys that came here as a decorated columnist. And the newspapers, I don't know if they encouraged you to talk more or less about it, but you did, because your picture in the corner was black and everybody else's was white, and a white guy couldn't write about a black guy's perspective other than with some sort of sympathy, or I don't know what it's like to be a woman in my case, or of your color in my case. But I would read it all the time, and there was a point in my 20s, maybe into my 30s, where I said, come on, dude. Do you have to be writing about race? I mean, can't you just cover the games? I mean, I felt that way. And now, 20 years later, having lived and seen, I'm glad people like you were writing about it there. Just to keep it on the back burner that 20 years later, I could stand embarrassed in front of you and say, you were right. They threw me out, too. They threw me out, too. So how about that, huh?
You know,
when you took this gig, you didn't know that you were getting another activist here, right? They took my career, too.
It's really interesting because, you know, not everybody admits that when they say, okay, you know, because I believe you, I've heard that so many times.
Have you?
I heard it before I became a columnist. But
because
I was just
your audience was 82% white, wherever you might have been.
Wherever I went.
Right?
Even
and
I was
like,
in New York, San Francisco.
Come on, dude, I'm with you. I vote with you. I'm good. But, like, you know, does it always have to? Well, if you're Adam Jones and you're in the outfield of Fenway Park and this is what's going on, then I guess that's what we have to. Yes, we have to address it. Yes.
Well,
yes.
Well. You think about it. You think about the things right here in town. You remember the baseball game? You know, what, 7 years ago? No spectators. No fans were allowed in there.
I remember that vividly.
Yeah. I mean,
I thought it was the dumbest thing I could ever imagine.
It's still mind blowing to me that's
more
mind blowing.
And look, I love Kevin Coward, and I almost invited him out because he lives in the neighborhood up here. But like, I had him on the air, and I'm like, you can't be serious. Like, did John Angelos pay you to write? I mean, like, you can't be serious. I lived downtown. I looked out the window. I watched the empty seats. I lived on the 23rd floor, three blocks away.
Right,
I saw the G.I. Joes all around my building, and I saw the tanks. And I'm like, you're playing a baseball game? Like, wait, have you completely lost your soul as to what you are, play that game in Bowie, play that game in Aberdeen, play it in Wilmington, play it somewhere.
Think of all the people who threw those ideas out there and apparently we just totally ignored. Or just said, no.
Well, look, I got a Cal Ripken jersey here. There's an Oriole motif, literally. Your head's kind of blocking it, which is really apropos. They're going to think I did that on purpose. Because your heads are...
Was that intentional?
Duck, David Steele. Have you seen this mural back here? You're new to Pappas.
Yeah, this is my first
time. So we're at Pappas in Cockeysville. That mural is made, this is hard for you to see, with bottle caps.
Wow, really?
Yeah, that's an unbelievable piece of art. So if you get the
so I walked past that, I had no idea
go check it out. It's one of a kind.
Absolutely.
It's an amazing, amazing piece. But when it comes to Oriole, it's just, you know, we'll talk about my press pass if you want to, but just the media in general and free speech in general and me telling you, pipe it down, African-American guy in 1999. You're writing too much about race. Yeah. And you're like, no, you don't understand. And I'd be like, well, maybe one day you'll understand, young man, you would say to me. And maybe one day you'll be the Latino getting thrown out of Owings Mills after doing your work for 26 years for no apparent reason and given no apparent reason other than, well, you're not really one of the top 64 quarterbacks or you're not really one of the top journalists in the city and you don't really have an audience. Like, so... The parallels for me for injustice, which is at the heart of all of it, right?
At the heart of
like where your spirit is and what you want to write about.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily just the games and in the case of Lamar sitting in the middle of this, this is one of the real big stories for the city and the future of the city and for him and for quarterbacks of his ilk, color, style. All of that, right?
And it's so funny when you mention that because it's part of writing a book, and I've been very, very fortunate that to have been part of writing three of them. And you have been very gracious. I cannot thank you enough for all the times you had me on to talk about Silent Gesture.
I love having you on.
With Tommy. That was phenomenal.
And I don't always get your crab cake like I did today at Pappas, but, you know.
That definitely cranked it up a level and everything. But, you know... To know that, you know, these are the topics that are out there. And also to tell you, and this is also part of It Was Always a Choice. It's like, you know, these things that we talk about, the exact same thing, the way you phrased it just now. Why do you have to make it about race? Why do you have to bring up race all the time? Why does it always have to be about blacks and things like that? These are the conversations they were having in 1968 around Tommy Smith and John Carlos. These are the conversations they were having in 1947 around, you know, Jackie Robinson. They were having him in 1936.
Or in my case,
around Jesse Owens.
In my case, in 1987, it's about whether Doug Williams could be a quarterback because he's black, or whether your kid could be a quarterback in the Pop Warner League or at the collegiate level, or whether they would say to Lamar Jackson 5 years ago, "You're a running back, kid.
You look a running back.
You look like a running back."
Yeah, hey, go run the 40 out here at the combine. Go, go see, catch a few passes, run a few pass patterns. Hey, show us your athleticism.
Or Hines Ward, who could be a quarterback at Georgia and a Hall of Fame wide receiver, right?
I mean, the thing that made me bring all this up is that I literally could have read a book twice as long as this.
Tell
I could have written
book,
four
man.
Or five volumes
so,
just
me,
about that.
Give me the birth of this because you write, I mean, I say you write books about race, sports, and America, right?
Yeah,
and the cultural impact of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I know what a great writer you are. Anybody's familiar with Dave's work at The Sun back 15 years ago now. And your work at Sporting News and, like, through all of that. Why this book right here, right? Because Kaepernick is a well-traversed topic that will probably... For the next 40 years, be a topic.
He's a part of it now. He's
part
of the
Luther
culture.
King of football.
He is. And people laughed and scoffed at that back in 2016 when he the very, very first time he took a knee. And before that, when he actually just sat down before he ever did, you know, evolved with the concept of taking a knee. The evolution of it, and we mentioned it because, like I said, I was fortunate enough to co-write Tommy Smith's autobiography. The 50th anniversary was in 2018, the 50th anniversary of Mexico City,
sure.
In 1968.
Summer I was conceived, by the way.
There you see. Yeah. Obviously an important year in the history of humanity.
68 was very important, yes.
Obviously. When I was,
Detroit was on fire the week I was born. I was born during the World Series.
See, there's been part of the research was just everything about 1968. I've become immersed in what that year was like all across the country because it was just so catastrophic in so many ways. But when I was with Sporting News, they said, let's do a big, big piece on the 50th anniversary. You know, look at where we are. And also sort of, you know, bring it up to where we are now because at that point, Kaepernick had been out of the league for 2 years. you know, he had been blackballed for 2 years. You know,
by the way, I asked that. Roger Goodell. I used the word blackball in the back of the press. Were you at that scrum at M&T when he put on the show upstairs and did the thing? And then he came down and did a scrum behind the press box.
Yeah.
And if you go back, I said, is Colin Kaepernick being blackballed? No, he's not being blackballed.
These are football decisions. I think football teams, absolutely.
We have 32 teams and have 32 opportunities. Right. And Bisciotti was a little bit in the game at that point until the pink pig socks showed up, right?
That was a very...
And his girlfriend, we've mentioned
that a few times on the show before, how that all evolved. And Ray Lewis and making the phone calls and just, yeah, that was fascinating. Yeah, that's sort of...
Well, that was the closest Kaepernick came to getting into the league,
right? That was the closest, yeah. And it's interesting because just earlier this week was the third anniversary of the big tryout down in Atlanta. You know, that was, moved from one place to another and everything. But anyway, you know, because
Pete Carroll was going to sign him.
There was a Pete Carroll thing for a while. Yeah, there was a Mike Brown thing for a while out in Cincinnati. There was mentioned at one point that apparently he had to make some promises and pledges. No, you cannot do this, and you aren't allowed to do that. And they just said, we're not going to compromise. But at that point, we're like, okay, how do we frame all of this? You know, comparing where we've come in the last 50 years. You know, where this puts the movement and the things that have been done and the way that people have handled it today. So I did it. I did a big piece, won a few awards, things like that. Fast forward to the summer of 2020, and we all know what happened there with George Floyd, the pandemic, what a lot of the NFL players did to push Roger Goodell into a corner and said, admit, hey, I misread you guys. I was wrong.
This was the fireside chat, remember?
Yes.
Goodell was drinking milk and cookies at midnight, right?
That whole year.
Well, he's usually on a stage being booed, so he will only be reading draft picks from his basement once in life, and it was that time.
That was an epic year. It's on so many levels.
Well, Bisciotti was about 6 weeks later doing the Black Lives Matter video, right?
And that's what, yeah.
That came in June.
The teams began to get in line. The league began to get in line.
Do Latin lives matter, Steve Bisciotti? Do Latin media members matter? Sorry, go ahead. It's going to be part of my shtick moving forward.
That's what it's all about. The book is there for everybody. That's the whole point. But that's what, the guy who I have representing me at the time said, hey, you know, as you're watching all this, and also remember that also at that time, this is when the NBA players walked out on the playoffs in protest of Jacob Blake out in Kenosha. And as we all remember, that led to Kyle Rittenhouse, two people getting killed, him going on trial and getting it was just, you know, that was what that year was about.
Him being martyred by 42% of the company.
Exactly. Right. He became a saint for all of that. He spoke at CPAC after that. But yeah, that's what that summer was like. So they said, look, is there a topic? Is there a way that you can turn that into a book? I said, well, look, I wrote this story a couple of years ago. This was centered on this. All we have to do is really update it about what's all going on right now. This moment that everyone believes that we're in, that this transitional moment, this social reckoning. How many times did we hear that phrase during the course of that summer? We are in a social reckoning. Things are going to change now. People were putting up the black squares on their social media accounts, and they were putting people. They were putting a CEO. They were hiring corporate DEI directors. You know, people at the corporate level. You know, they were promising and pledging things and hiring, committing money to it.
There was all this
money that was going to go flowing into it and everything. And so I said, well, let's look at this. Look at where we are at that moment in 2020. And this is when the protests were at their peak. Say, let's see if within the next 6-7 months we can pull this all together and turn it into a book. And the result is this book.
It was always a choice, a closely observed, well-argued examination of how athletes have used their fame to advance civil rights. David Steele is our guest. We're out of Pappas. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play. Got some scratch-offs. Had some very happy people. We had a $20 winner today here at Pappas Restaurant in Cockeysville. Also brought to you by our friends at Goodwill. And they're getting jobs, lifting folks up during the holidays, and certainly next week with some turkeys, as well as our friends at Window Nation. I will have an update after Thanksgiving for Crab Cake Tour stops in December, January. I'm happy that Dave's been down here to talk about So when I think of activism and athlete activism, and I know 68 with what you've written about, Ali on the pathway to this, another guy that's been written about more than anyone, right? But it's taken me all of my lifetime to understand my own childhood, segregation, Turner Station, Dundalk High School, why all the African Americans sat in one corner for lunch in 1982, 83, 84. And Ali being the first and really the most brave of, no offense to your guys in you know, in Mexico City, but Ali was the innovator of this, right? He was the first to have the kind of courage. And listen, I've had Mark Cram on talking about Joe Frazier and both sides of where the money was made and who's Uncle Tom and all of that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But Ali would be the lightning rod that would, I mean, his name's in this book, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's all over the book. Yeah, it's not an entire chapter devoted to him, but one thing to remember, that was something that was brought up in Silent Gesture, but also I made emphasis in here. What Ali did preceded what Tommy Smith and John Carlos said. One of the demands that they made from the IOC, with the Olympic Project for Human Rights, was to reinstate Ali, give him his heavyweight title back, drop all the charges, stop calling
him. They were catalysts.
Oh, yeah. He was part of it. Well, a lot part of it was to get South Africa and Rhodesia out of the Olympic movement and to sort of just turn their backs on apartheid, because the leaders of the IOC and the USOC were big supporters of those regimes and of those governments. And that was all part and parcel of all of this. And Ali was like a part of it. I mean, remember, and again, you talk about how you grew up. And
Is that how Ali went up in Zaire fighting?
That was a big part of it. Yeah,
he wanted to bring awareness.
He said, "I've got. I am the most powerful name and voice in heavyweight boxing, really, in the world of sports. And if I want to have..."
No, he's the most powerful man of color in the world, probably at that point, right?
"And if I want to have a heavyweight title fight on the continent of Africa, then you guys are going to hold a heavyweight title fight on the continent of Africa." And that's how that ended up in Zaire.
I learned things when I have... since I lost Goldstein and Stedman and the guys that, you know, lived through all this. I mean, Goldie sat one day at his kitchen table at the end of his life with his wife over in Pikesville, like right at the edge of Mount Washington. And I sat in his kitchen table when his wife made me tea. And we sat for 4 hours telling old bullet stories. I run them. Old bullet stories. But he and Jackman and Mike Marlowe, who was my boss at the Evening Sun back in the day, told me the stories. And I saw a famous writer this week said that the greatest thing he ever witnessed was Ali in Pennsylvania training. Right, that they literally drove up to Pennsylvania, and Ali was like outside of a cabin, shadow boxing and sparring in a ring, and writers would come, and it was this time he's the most famous guy like literally in the world right at the time, and he was happy to engage. The more you wanted to talk about race or deep thoughts or politics or money, the more he wanted to talk about it. Mm-hmm. That has not been the case for most modern athletes since, right?
Well,
I'm looking at Cal Ripken jersey over there. Cal would and Cal would be the first to admit, Cal's not political. Cal played baseball, and Cal did good things for the community. But Cal didn't want to, you know
that
what I mean?
That was not,
certainly not at the top of anyone. Michael Jordan has been accused of looking the other... Is it in here?
Michael's in there.
That I know about it.
Michael's
right?
in there. But O.J. Simpson's in there. Tiger Woods is in there. They're all in the chapter talking about the guys who made a choice. Again, you know, it was a very conscious decision on what to name the book. Who guys who made the choice to say, no, I don't want to be Ali. I don't want to be Tommy Smith. I want to just be a quote unquote athlete.
Wouldn't it be something if Chad Steele let me back in Owings Mills and I really got to sit down with Lamar Jackson and would say to Lamar Jackson, "What'd you learn from this guy? But I'm not allowed to ask questions. I mean, because I would have a good question. But Lamar's stepping into this spot, as is, for better or worse, all the good and bad that comes with Deshaun Watson, race, quarterback, league, all of that. That black quarterback. We're not going back to the days of Shaq Harris and." You know, you're going to be a wide receiver. We're paving ground here for any young man who can play a little differently, a little different size, a little different style. Lamar's laying the groundwork, and this contract and where Bisciotti is and where this franchise is and where Lamar's heart is, because I am of the mindset at this point that Lamar's going to go somewhere else because he didn't get to dance with this girl. That's where it's, I am.
I'm still leaving space for that to happen. I mean, I think that, you know, we see what Lamar is and what he means to this franchise and what he means to just the entire sport and to all the topics that we're talking about.
It was the story of the league all summer.
It is a really threshold moment that him and this franchise and this league are going through right now. And again, that's something that's sort of a part and parcel of this whole story. Well, are you going to allow Lamar Jackson just to be Lamar Jackson? And if that and is that in and of itself an incredible act of not necessarily protest, but of speaking out, using a platform, and you know, making social change? Because every other quarterback, all the ones we talked about before, they all had to fit into a mold. Doug Williams had to be a certain kind of quarterback, and Shaq Harris had to be a certain kind of quarterback.
And Warren Moon.
And Warren Moon
had to be the kind of guy that went to Canada.
Right. Mm-hmm. He was that guy. He was that kind of quarterback. He was not a scrambler. He wasn't a runner. He wasn't a quote-unquote athlete, and they still didn't draft him. And he still ended up going to
Canada.
Yeah,
you look like you can run.
Yeah, you look athletic. Yeah. That's the thing. All you look at all the others. We will never know if Tony Dungy would have been a starting NFL quarterback, because the moment he came into the league in the 70s, they moved him to defensive back. And this is quarterback. We can remember every quarterback we grew up watching in college, every black quarterback. I remember watching Cornelius Green because he's from D.C.
I remember Cornelius Green running with Archie Griffin. I'm
telling you, my family got up and watched the Rose Bowl that day. Because we said, no, he's from D.C. We are going to watch this. This is good. This is a seminal moment. I probably wasn't saying seminal. I was like 8 years old or whatever. But it's like, this is a huge, this is a massive, massive moment. And he never got a shot in the NFL at all. And we've just gone through this. And this, again, this is how you grew up. This is how I grew up. And there were very few people who were able to go out there and say, no, this isn't right. And if we did, you know, those of us who did say that, you know, we were told, stop focusing on race. It may be the one thing we ever said about race ever in all our times as newspaper journalists. I mean, look, when I was at the Sun, the majority of the time, I was out at the ballpark writing about the Orioles. I was out at the stadium writing about the Ravens.
But you were on the NBA beat before that.
I was on the NBA.
The NBA is a different kind.
NBA is very different.
The NBA has been a leader in all of this because out of necessity.
They've been ahead of the curve because they recognize. But also, you have to remember that it took until David Stern came over for them to really embrace it, because they really kind of fought against it for a long, long time. They still felt like they had to have a minimum number of white players on the court, on the roster, to sell as superstars. You know, they were finding it for a long time very difficult to sell Dr. J to the masses, Kareem to the masses, even Russell and Chamberlain. You know, they found that a hard time. They couldn't get a really great TV contract, even though that was like the definitive one-on-one rivalry in all of sports for like a decade. And NBA was still like, you know, running behind everybody else in ratings.
It was
way
too
behind
black.
Baseball.
Let's just say it was too
that's
black.
What it was. Yeah. You know, there were very few people who would say it out loud, but everybody
1984,
knew it.
1984. That's where the world. That's why their games were on tape delay.
That's how we woke up. That's how we grew up. We would be like watching the game, watching the news.
Why can't we have playoff games?
They don't show.
I used to watch the Bullets on Channel 20 through the snow with the right because you right.
Absolutely.
I was always a Captain Chespy guy, not a captain. What was his name? Captain 20. That was his name. See? He knew that.
Oh, yeah.
David Steele.
How do you forget that?
Yeah, you're D.C., you're Baltimore. We used to share a baseball team and things like that.
Remember that?
They tried to make us share the football team. We'll get to that in a moment as well. The book is It Was Always a Choice, Picking Up the Baton of Athlete Activism, David Steele. Stay for another segment. I'll take a break. Sure. We'll come back and we'll talk about other stuff. Is that cool?
That's cool.
All right, we're having crab cakes. We're at Pappas in Cockeysville. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play. I'm giving away some scratch-offs here. A whole table full of great folks here from Care First Blue Cross. Shout out to Brian Pinnock on that as well. Our friends at Window Nation, 86698. I got new windows back at the end of summer, and the windows are 45 years old. They were falling apart. Window Nation came in. The thing that I've noticed, it's been 20 degrees every day. Completely different climate in my building now that we have real good windows. I don't know what the bill's going to be. I'll let you know when I get the bills at the end of summer or at the end of the season. but I feel the warmth in our place much more so than it was last winter. So thanks to Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. Also, our friends at Goodwill will be serving some less fortunate folks on Thanksgiving Eve, which is Wednesday the 23rd. If you want to help down at the Convention Center, the helping time, the call time is 10 a.m. So we'll be downtown, well-fed at 10 a.m. If you want to help out, that's at BaltimorePositive.com. Goodwill and our friends at Wise Markets. And I have my Wise... I had a Wise thing to show. Gosh, I forgot it. I forgot my ice cream scooper. I was eating ice cream with that. Oh, man, we got World Series champions. Mike Bordick. Did you win a World Series? No, you can't play. No, I was there. We talked about that last time. David Steele is here. You know, I might mix and match and bring Bordick in here, too, because there was a panel the other night about how athletes get along with journalists. So we're going to break all the molds here today. I didn't know. Mike Preston and Ken Rosenthal, they wanted real reporters. They didn't call me. They heard I've been thrown out of the Orioles and the Ravens. I am Nestor. We're back for more at Pappas right after this in Cockeysville. It's Baltimore Positive. Stay with us.